Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the central coast of California at 464-8295. But I'm going to ask if you'll hold your calls for the time being and really not call in until we ask for calls, because we have a list this evening of Paul Thompson, and we're going to be talking about his book, The Terror Timeline, year by year, day by day, minute by minute, a comprehensive chronicle of the road to 911 and America's response. Well, Mr. Thompson, my understanding is an American who lives in New Zealand, who became fascinated with this history of 911 after it occurred, and began simply collecting all sorts of newspaper and television reports about this, and eventually he ended up with well over 100 three-ring binders, maybe more than that. I'm going to let him tell you about his search, and then, of course, how this became the Paul Thompson timeline, and of course it was published on the internet, but here you have it in book form with so much more information, fascinating material. Mr. Thompson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now, you are an American that lives in New Zealand?
I am, yeah, at the moment.
All right, fine. And of course, what motivated you to do this Herculean job of amassing all of this information from just public sources?
Well, I kind of fell into it. I wonder if I know now what I, you know, just how big a task it is if I would have done it. But it started about the middle of 2002. There were a number of stories that came out all at once that got me interested in 9/11, because up until that time I hadn't really paid any special attention to it. But you had the Colleen Rowley story. You know, she was the Minnesota FBI agent and later made the Time Person of the Year. And there was the Ken Williams memo, the FBI agent in Arizona, and there was the Bush PDB, they call it, the daily briefing that said Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. So a number of these stories seemed to all come out around the same time, and I went online and I started looking all over the internet, and I found all kinds of other information that I'd never heard of. And it seemed like the more that I found, I would find one interesting article, and then that would lead me to three more, and then I would look at that one, and I would, you know, it just kept growing and growing and growing.
Until eventually, of course, you begin putting this together and compiling it in a timeline that really is fascinating, and for our listeners out there, I recommend it. I've been studying this for a long time, as many of our listeners know, but I've learned a lot from what I've read so far, Paul Thompson's timeline. Not only that, but the foreword is written by our good friend Peter Lance, who we had as a guest just this morning. We've had many times, and Peter certainly has done a yeoman's job of investigative reporting, but what Paul Thompson has done is simply to pull together all of the information that is up there on the internet, is available from radio, from so many sources that he's put together. And as you begin to read all of this, you realize that there was ample prior knowledge. You heard it said, oh, we just couldn't get anybody into Al-Qaeda. You know, they were a closed organization. There was no way we could know what was going on. Of course we had people in Al-Qaeda. Now, the Moroccans had people in Al-Qaeda and were telling us what was happening. The Egyptians had people in Al-Qaeda. The Mossad had people in Al-Qaeda. Everybody knew what was going to happen. In fact, even the children at the schools in New York were taking their cameras to school on the morning of September 11th to see the attack and take pictures of the attack. But the FBI had no idea what was happening. Do you really believe? Well, you won't believe much you've heard before after reading Paul Thompson's timeline, The Terror. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Paul Thompson. And so anyway, Paul, eventually you put together this amazing compilation. It's almost 600 pages of just jam full of information about what happened that fateful morning. So after putting it all together, what's your impression?
Well, I put it together from about 5,000 mainstream articles, and I'd like to mention to the readers that everything in that book is backed up from, you know, quote-unquote mainstream New York Times, CBS, Washington Post, LA Times. So this is very reputable information that came in there. And I don't really have kind of an overall theory about 9/11. I have some maybe you might want to call them sub-theories, some particular ideas, but I deliberately tried not to come up with an overall theory because I want to be impartial. I don't want to start having some, you know, pet theory and then push that on everybody. I thought there are other people doing that. My role is to try to collect all the information and present it in a way that allows other people to look at it and make up their own minds. And that's something I've really strived to do.
And I think that's a very, very wise position to take. Because, of course, you've got so much information that there was foreknowledge of the attack, not overseas, but right here in the United States. And, you know, the airlines that would send out, or at least the FAA would send out, notifications of the impending attack to the airlines. And, oh, shucks, the airlines just wouldn't be able to get, nobody ever told the airlines what the FAA was saying. And we find, supposedly, there are all sorts of barriers within the FBI that can't talk to one another. And a lot of this is just sort of contrived, isn't it?
Well, when you say foreknowledge, I think we have to make a distinction between foreknowledge and warnings. We have a lot of evidence, I think much more than just about anybody realizes, of warning after warning coming in. And then the question is, who saw those warnings, and did they put it together? Did they make sense of it? But, like what you were saying earlier about all these people having moles in Afghanistan, one thing that I just discovered lately, and I just barely managed to squeeze it in the book, but I was glad I was able to get it in under the wire there, was that one of the last things to come out of the 9/11 Commission was they said in one of their statements that in the summer of 2001, Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan was actually publicly talking about the 9/11 attacks. He was having these large meetings, with a mosque or in front of a training camp audience, and he would say to a crowd of people things like, let's all say a prayer to the 20 suicide attackers on their mission.
Hold that stuff right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Paul Thompson, and of course we're talking about his book, The Terror Timeline, and incidentally I ordered some of these the other day because I think it's a very important book. I think it will really help you to give tremendous insight, and it's all there, so much of this as references to where you can verify everything he said. But Paul was just saying that if you read is that the staff report you're referring to?
Yeah, the 9/11 Commission? Staff reports. One of their latest. And as I was saying, so you have bin Laden saying, let's say a prayer for the 20 martyrs. He also says there's going to be an attack in the U.S. and thousands will die. So he's saying this to large groups of people. And the commission goes on to say that throughout the fundamentalist Muslim community in the whole world, communicating through chat rooms and emails and so forth, word of this attack spread throughout the whole world. So when you're talking about something you mentioned earlier, how even students in New York City and cab drivers and all kinds of different people, there's an account in the Village Voice of a cab driver who warned a reporter before the attack, that this had just spread so far. And how could the U.S. miss out on hearing about the attacks when it seemed just about everybody else and all these other intelligence agencies were able to figure it out?
I heard the story that somebody was trying to get a cab that morning, or early in the morning, at airport or wherever it was, somewhere in New York, and he just couldn't get a cab. And, in New York, why, you never see, I mean, yes, cabs everywhere. So finally this cab driver stops for him, and he gets in, and the fellow says, where are all the cabs, you know? And the fellow said, well, all the cab drivers called in sick this morning. Had you heard that story?
No, and, you know, some stories like that, it's hard to say if they're true or if they're not. There's a lot of urban legends floating around, but there's one cab story that is, I think, verified, which is that there was this Village Voice reporter a month or two earlier talking to her cab driver who was from the Middle East, from Egypt, and the cab driver said, "I'm getting out of here by late August because I don't want to be here when the big attack happens."
Yeah.
And so she told this after 9/11 to the FBI. The FBI investigated, found out that, in fact, the cab driver had left the country right when he said he would. So you find a lot of this evidence of word of the plot spreading far and wide. In fact, one of the foreign warnings, you mentioned the Egyptian government warning the U.S. with their mole. They, 60 Minutes actually had a story where they said that the Egyptian intelligence agency in July 2001 warned the CIA, saying that there are 20 Al-Qaeda agents in the United States. Four of them are training on light aircraft preparing for an attack. And the story went on to say that the Egyptians expected a response from the CIA to follow up asking for more information, and the CIA wasn't even interested and didn't follow it up.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of research on this, but I learned some fascinating things reading this. One of the most interesting parts of the whole story is that in April of 2000, into the Newark office of the FBI walks a man, and he says, I'm a terrorist and I've been trained. We're going to hijack your planes, and I'm part of a team of six or seven people, and I'm to get in touch with them here in New Jersey or New York or someplace, and I want to tell you, we're going to hijack a 747. And the story, as it was told to the Joint Select Intelligence Committee, was the fact that he had said, we are going to hijack the plane and we are going to fly it to Afghanistan. And that was Eleanor Hill's testimony before the Joint Select Committee on it. That was we actually have that testimony. But what you pointed out is when this fellow was interviewed by British newspapers, he said, I told them we were going to hijack the planes and crash them into the buildings. Well, of course, what was so amazing about the story was that, why don't you tell the story? Because I think that is one of the most amazing story. Here it is, April of 2000. This fellow walks in and he says, I'm a terrorist, and we're here to hijack your planes and crash them into buildings. So what happened then?
Yeah, I believe his name is Niaz Khan, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And you're right that the story changed between the original investigation by Congress in 2002, and then it was earlier this year that he came out and publicly identified himself, and there were a number of stories, mostly in Britain, but I think NBC did a good piece on him. And he was basically a compulsive gambler who somehow got involved with Al-Qaeda. He was also, you know, I guess intellectually sympathetic with them, and they gave him a whole bunch of money. And as a compulsive gambler, he spent the money that he was supposed to use for his terrorist purposes, and so he got afraid that they would, you know, do something to him in response, get some kind of revenge, so he turned himself in New Jersey. And the New Jersey people held him, the FBI there held him for a couple weeks, and didn't quite know what to do with him. They found his story incredible. One of the agents said something like, you know, yeah, we could imagine these guys riding around on camels, but we couldn't imagine them crashing airplanes in the building.
But they gave him lie detector tests, and he passed two of them. So
yeah, he passed them, and then I believe it was the NBC story had this interesting detail that said that some of the New Jersey FBI found him credible, but from headquarters they got the message saying basically get rid of this guy.
Well, not only that, they told him to send him back to England and have the FBI agents go with him to make sure he got out of the country. Now, you would think that if there was any possibility, they would have tried to use him to infiltrate the cell and find out what they were going to do. It seemed like they didn't want to find out who the hijackers were in this country, or at least not have it on record that they knew who the hijackers were.
Yeah, and then he goes back to Britain, and the British intelligence interview him for a few hours, and then they just sort of dump him out on the street and say, you know, that's it. And he couldn't believe it, you know, because he had all this information, and he trained in Pakistan with a number of other people, and he said, you know, I could have identified the training camp, and And his story has been verified in the wake of 9/11.
Well, you would think that somebody would have been fired for incompetence. Instead, they've all been promoted. So either the higher-ups in the FBI are totally incompetent and they won't fire incompetents, or the higher-ups in the FBI are rewarding those people, you know, for actually doing what they wanted to, and that is getting that man out of the country during the Second World War. Why, there were 8 German spies that came to America. They came in off a submarine. They came in, they were going to commit all sorts of acts of sabotage, and one of them turned himself into the FBI, and so they used him to track down the other 7, and the other 7 were executed, or 6 of the 6 of the 8 were executed. Why didn't they try to find out who the terrorists were in the United States? Here was a man who was willing to help them, and they sent him to England. In fact, they not only sent him to England, they had the FBI agents go with him to make sure that he got out of the country. And you have to ask yourself, why would they do something like that unintentionally?
Yeah, well, I try not to, you know,
you
to speculate
to
where... But one thing that I've noticed, a pattern that I've noticed, is that it seems that the people who really messed up with 9/11-related issues have been promoted, and the whistleblowers who have been trying to point out all the flaws of these agencies have either been fired or ostracized, harassed, and basically their warnings, their whistleblowing-type warnings that things are very wrong inside the government, those have gone unheeded, and you know, basically they've been tried to bury those kinds of stories. Like Sybil Edmonds, you may have heard of her. She's a classic example.
Why don't you tell our listeners about Sybil or Sybil?
Well, Sybil is how you pronounce her name. She was hired just after 9/11 as a FBI translator, like a week after 9/11. And at that time, they were starting to go through all the messages that they'd gotten in the months previous, and they were wondering, you know, did we miss something? So they're going back and looking at them all. And then also there was all kinds of new things coming in, worrying about the next Al-Qaeda attack. So this was a time, it was a very important time to really get these things translated and protect the country from who knows what. And her boss at the time, apparently, according to Sybil Edmonds' accusation, and both Democratic and Republican senators have looked at the evidence and backed her up on this, her boss would, at the end of the day, delete all of her work. And not only her work, but for the other people around her. He was deliberately sabotaging, time after time, all the translation work that they were doing for these very important translations.
And they tell them not to work so hard because they wanted a big backlog so they could get more money. The bigger the backlog, the more money they could get. And I've just read an article today. They're doing exactly the same thing. They've got thousands, 100,000 messages that should be translated. They can't get them translated. But the reason is they're not trying to translate them. And I saw Sybil on 60 Minutes telling this story that she was told by her employer, do not work so fast. We want to have a big backlog.
Yeah,
why? We're really faced with a terrorist threat in America. Is the FBI not trying to do what they're supposed to do and have all the information available?
Yeah, he was very explicit about it, saying, you know, I'm doing this so that we can get a bigger budget and so forth. And then he goes on to be promoted. Not only that, but another one of her allegations is that there was essentially a foreign spy ring within the United States government.
Working for the FBI there.
Well, that there was another translator in her department who tried to recruit her into the spy ring, and that other translator claimed that this spy ring had moles in the State Department and in the Pentagon and who knows where else, and it has never been identified who these spies were working for. We don't know that, there was a recent FBI report into Sybil Edmonds' accusations, and they basically either verified it or said, there's nothing that we could disprove. So I think she has some very strong allegations, and the people who are involved in this are actually being promoted.
And she got fired as a whistleblower for saying, and one of the things she said was there was evidence that they knew what was going to happen, or words to that effect. We'll get back to that in just a moment with this fascinating book, The Terror Timeline by Paul Thompson, who is our guest this evening here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Paul Thompson, and we're talking about his book, The Terror Timeline. And you almost really need to know where to begin with this. And so let's just start at the beginning. And as Paul does, it's really in the late 1970s. So why don't you start telling the story, Paul?
Well, the first entry I have, it's all these timeline entries of sort of paragraph-sized summaries of news articles. And the very first one is from 1979, and it's the beginning of the Afghanistan war between the Soviet Union and the Mujahideen, the Afghan rebels. And to everybody's surprise, after about 10 years, the Afghan rebels actually defeated the Soviet Union and led to the demise of the Soviet Union. It was one of the things they say that brought the Soviet Union down just 2 years later. What a lot of people don't know is that according to Carter's national security advisor, I have difficulty with his name, but
Zygmunt Brzezinski,
he says that 6 months prior to the beginning of the Afghan war, the U.S. had a bunch of covert operations in Afghanistan to draw the Soviet Union into invading the country.
With the idea that they would draw them into a war that would be their Vietnam, and just as we had been drawn into a war in Vietnam. So this would be the Soviet Vietnam would be in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that he, you know, and later, I believe it was in 98, he sort of boasted about this. But there was this unintended consequence. The actual goal was wildly successful. It was the Soviet Union's Vietnam. But the unintended consequence was that in the process you created literally tens of thousands of trained, very fundamentalist, veteran fighters. And they came from all over the world to fight in Afghanistan. And when the war was over, they went back to all their home countries, and many of them became terrorists.
And so we trained them in explosives. We trained them into all the things that they needed to become terrorists. But what was really more interesting is that the CIA actually participated in recruiting these Mujahideen, these holy warriors, to come to Afghanistan. And didn't we actually, of course, push this whole idea that this was a holy war? They were carrying out Allah's will. Weren't we, in many ways, actually creating this whole Islamic terrorist movement?
Yeah, well, what the U.S. found was that the most fervent fighters in the Afghan war were the most religiously fanatical. And so time and time again, they and the Pakistanis, and the U.S. was working very closely with Pakistan on this, they picked the most radical, sort of Western-hating factions to give them the most weapons and the most arms. And bin Laden was involved in all this. We don't know the exact relationship between bin Laden and the U.S., in the 80s, but there was certainly at least a marriage of convenience there. And so a lot of the names of the terrorists that we see later were trained at this time with U.S. money. And the prime minister of Pakistan at the time, Benir Bhutto, a woman, she said to the U.S., she said, "You are creating a Frankenstein. You will regret this later." And so that's why my book begins with that war, because it's a phenomenon known as blowback, that, you know, it comes back to haunt you sometimes, the consequences of your actions. And this was a very large example of blowback.
And so what Michael is saying, in essence, is that the United States funded the Mujahideen, brought many of them, along with Pakistan, brought them in there, trained them in terrorism, and then, of course, when they won the war, why, now they were committed to the Islamic War. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Paul Thompson. We're talking about his book, The Terror Timeline, fascinating book. And we've simply been going into the background of how this whole episode started, really in 1979, with Zygmunt Brzezinski, who was President Carter's foreign policy advisor, who a decade later admitted what really happened in 79, and that is we were beginning to fund of factions within Afghanistan were in opposition to the puppet Soviet government there, with a full intent of getting the Soviets to invade Afghanistan so we could have a war. We wanted a war. We wanted to draw the Soviets into war. We did draw the Soviets into a war. Then we brought in the opposition fighters, and they were, of course, the Muslims from throughout the world. And as Paul Thompson points out, the best fighters were those who looked upon this with religious zeal. who felt that they were fighting for Allah, who believed in this radical form of Islam that had lain dormant for almost a century. And we financed its resurgence. And one of the things you brought out, I thought, in your book was something about a man named Michael Springman. Would you like to tell that story? Because I think that is one of the most interesting parts of the story, how we trained many of these people, not simply in Afghanistan, but right here in the United States. Tell that story, would you?
Well, he was a consular official in the U.S. Embassy in Jeddah, which is one of the big cities in Saudi Arabia. And he claims that at the time, this is the late 1980s, that they were getting a lot of applications to have people come to the U.S. for visas, Saudis. And these are extremely dubious applications, and he was rejecting them right and left. But some powers that be higher than him said, basically, you will give these particular applications a free pass. And so he got in a lot of trouble because he kept, you know, complaining and trying to take that to the top, and everybody just wanted to get these really bad people, clearly unqualified people, into the U.S. And it appeared to be that these were some of the people who were fighting in Afghanistan. And even after the Afghanistan war ended, you had some extremely dangerous people who were getting visas to come to the U.S. One really classic example is the so-called blind sheikh, Sheikh Abdul Rahman, who was one of the major figures in the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993 and some other attacks. He was actually on a watch list preventing him from coming to the U.S. because he was considered to be a major terrorist. And a CIA agent filled out his application and got him a special pass to come and live in the U.S., where he immediately set about plotting to destroy the World Trade Center and a number of other buildings.
So, now, you wonder if that CIA agent who brought this known terrorist, the man who was behind the first World Trade Center bombing, it was actually closely aligned with Osama bin Laden at the time, the CIA got him into the country over violation of our laws. I wonder if that CIA agent was ever fired.
Yeah, well, one
or
of
maybe
the
maybe he got promoted.
One of the problems about all of this is the culture of secrecy, where we often don't know what's really going on, and so the mistakes can't be rectified. If you complain about something, you want to know something, and somebody just says, well, we can't tell you because of national security, then that's a free pass to just let all the problems that exist remain unsolved. I think this is one of the big problems we face today.
Well, I think what's so interesting about this Michael Springman testimony, actually, I interviewed Michael Springman. We have an interview with him. He tells exactly what you do. But he came to the conclusion that this was the CIA who was ordering him. The CIA agents operating in the consulate there in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, were ordering to let these people into the United States who were not qualified to come. Later he found out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but later he found out that these were CIA people, and the ones that they were bringing into the United States were terrorists. They were bringing them in or to train them in various terrorist techniques. Would that be a fair statement?
Well,
or would just say that they were Mujahideen. We were bringing them into the United States for military training.
Yeah, I think the latter, and then many of them went on to become terrorists. But I think what's also really interesting about what he has to say is he you know, no longer worked throughout most of the 90s and leading up to 9/11. But if you look at the visa applications for the 9/11 hijackers, most of them are from Saudi Arabia, and all of them that were from Saudi Arabia, I believe 15, they all got their visa applications approved through Jeddah, the same place he was.
Where, of course, the CIA really ran, or at least was very influential in the visa office. Actually, I interviewed a man named Colonel Bill Greitz, who was with Special Forces, worked with the CIA, and he talked about training these Afghan fighters here in all sorts of warfare techniques. I think they were being trained, actually, in Nevada. And that's it. We'll be re-interviewing Bo Greitz next week or so, and I'll confirm this statement. But we bought them here for military training right to the United States.
But if I could point out also that virtually every single one of these applications should have been easily rejected on its face. Some of them are almost comically bad. So was what Michael Springman saying still happening?
Thank you. this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Paul Thompson, and of course, Michael Springman felt that these people should not have been admitted to the United States back in 1987, 1989. When he was working in Jeddah, he was ordered to let them come to the United States in violation of our laws, and the people who were giving him a bad time and really got him fired were, at least my understanding, they were from the CIA. But then you fast forward a decade, and you have these people, of course, coming into the United States. And, of course, they shouldn't have been allowed to come in. Many of them should not. They were going through the same office in Jeddah, the same visa office, of which a decade earlier had been under CIA control. You sort of, I'm sure, that was the point you were trying to make?
Yes. And even Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the so-called 9/11 mastermind and a wanted man, he had a $2 million reward poster out. The Jeddah office actually gave him a visa to come to the U.S. In June 2001. So something's clearly very wrong there.
In fact, I don't know. I haven't looked at your reference to 1995, but we know that al-Zawahiri, who's the right-hand man of Osama bin Laden, a well-known terrorist involved with the assassination of President Sadat in Egypt, but this well-known terrorist is allowed to come to the United States and tour the United States in 1995, collecting money and buying various tools and things that they need for their war against America, satellite phones, phones and that sort. And even 1995, they're allowing known terrorists to come to the United States. I don't think our immigration service is that foolish. I think that they were probably pressured, just like Michael Springman was, but that, of course, is my conjecture. All I know is that he was here, but the average American doesn't understand that there always seems to be a welcome mat for the most violent of the terrorists in the United States, and I don't think that's really happening unintentionally. Well, let's get back. We start with 1979. Your story then takes you through the early 1980s, and you point out that the United States government is financing textbooks in Saudi Arabia, in Afghanistan, for the children there, that is introducing them into this radical form of Islam. Now, would you like to tell that story? Because I think this is one of the most telling parts of this whole incredible story. Because either we have the stupidest people in our government, or they were intentionally encouraging this radical Islamic belief and trying to get this the embers of radical Islam reignited into a flaming forest fire that one day may very well engulf the world. What was that story about USAID in the textbooks?
Well, before I mention that, I just want to follow up with the other point. You know, you're talking about al-Zawahiri coming into the country. There was another guy coming.
Hold that thought right there.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Paul Thompson. Fascinating book. Of course, it's The Terror Timeline, and if you don't have a copy of it, you want to have it, you want to read it, you want to study it. Go ahead. You were talking about some fellow coming into the country?
Yeah, there was another person by the name of Muhammad Jamal Khalifa, and he's the actual brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden. He came into the country and was arrested in 1995, and he appeared to be a major terrorist. He had all kinds of ties to Al-Qaeda and other terrorist insurgent groups. He was caught with all kinds of very incriminating material, you know, weapons manuals and training manuals and all kinds of things. And the U.S. held him for some months and then just let him go. And I have some quotes from some agents at the time who are saying, even at the time, we would just shook our heads in complete belief. We could not conceive how this person could be let go when he was such an obvious major terrorist. So there's a lot of very curious things going on. Now, let me just quickly jump over to what else you were talking about, which was this program, this textbook program. For many years, the United States developed the textbooks that were widely used in Afghanistan, and these textbooks were very, very violent textbooks. These are for little children and on up. You would have math problems like, you know, if you have two AK-47 machine guns and someone gives you three more AK-47 machine guns, how many do you have now?
That's a math question.
Yeah, it's a math question. You know, but they're all using this sort of violent imagery, war imagery, jihad, religious war imagery. And these textbooks were still in use widely all the way up to and after 9/11. So when you look at how religiously extreme many of the people in that part of the world are, you can really thank the American tax dollar for that.
In other words, education frames our worldview, and what we were doing was funding a resurgence of this radical form of Islam, and in these textbooks, of course, they glorified dying for Allah and fighting for Allah, and everything was for Allah, and really doing everything they could to bring back this radical form of Islam that had lain dormant for a century, funded with $51 million of your tax money through USAID, and of course the USAID said, well, if we hadn't had that in there, they wouldn't have used those textbooks. We had this radical form of Islam that, of course, don't you dare mention the word Jesus Christ in a textbook in the United States, but we can fund radical Islam halfway around the world, and as Michael is saying, pardon me, as Paul is saying, those textbooks were used up until recently when the president said, we're going to change those textbooks because that's the sort of thing that would just inflame the radical form of Islam, and I wonder who in USAID has been fired for fomenting this radical form of Islam.
Probably nobody.
Probably nobody. Okay, fine. So then, of course, we get up. This takes us pretty well towards the latter part of the 1980s, up around 1989. When does Al-Qaeda actually become a major factor, and when does Osama bin Laden surface as the leader of this Islamic terrorist movement?
Well, as far as we know, Al-Qaeda was formed in 1989, and it had its roots earlier. It kind of took over an existing organization. And it starts, the first terror act that we know of was a murder of a rabbi in New York City in 1990. And then as the 90s go on, there are more and more acts of terror, including the attempt to destroy the World Trade Center in 1993.
Could before we got into that, could we get into a fellow named Azam, Abdul Azam, who was actually here in 1988, advocating terror, and of course the FBI was taking pictures of him, and we have that in a video called Jihad in America. It was put out by Stephen Emerson, but suppressed in America. It was shown only one time in America, in free America, where we have freedom of the press, but it was only allowed to be shown one time in 1994, because here's the FBI taking pictures of Abdullah Azam back in 1988 in Oklahoma City, advocating a bloodbath and jihad and blood running in the streets of America. And so he's really the leader of this whole Al-Qaeda movement, isn't he?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before, I just made a brief reference to bin Laden taking over an existing organization, and that was Azam's when he was killed in about 88, 89, and so there were at that time all these different centers in the United States, about 30 of them, that was part of his group, which was called the Services Office, and they just morphed into Al Qaeda offices, basically.
Right.
And yet the United States government remained oblivious to this, and some say they didn't even really figure out the name Al-Qaeda until about 1996.
Well, because the FBI was told that they couldn't investigate this. They had pictures of these people in 1989, many of them involved in the bombing of the first bombing of the World Trade Center. In 1989, they were out actually at military camps somewhere in New England shooting automatic weapons, and the FBI was there taking pictures of them. A lot of those people were involved in the killing of Kahana. They were involved in the plot to blow up 12 sites in New York. They were involved in the first World Trade Center bombing. And the FBI knew who these people were. They'd been watching them. They'd been taking motion pictures of them from distances. And yet, of course, nothing is being done. And everybody tries to do the investigation. The FBI seems to be called back almost as if we weren't trying to do anything, or I didn't want to have any record of the fact that we knew what they were doing.
Well, what you're talking about here is something that Peter Lance discusses a lot in his book, and I agree with him that this is some very important material, yet if you look at the 9/11 Commission, they completely ignore all of this stuff. They essentially said that we're looking back to about 1998, maybe in some instances going back to 1996, because that's as far as we see things developing. But in fact, as you're pointing out, that really the roots of 9/11 go all the way back to the late 1980s, a cell of Al-Qaeda people being formed in New York that becomes very central to the whole 9/11 plot. And the plot was really, you know, at least going back as far as 1994, the idea that these, you know, some of the terrorists are sitting around and coming up with the idea of crashing airplanes into the CIA headquarters, into the World Trade Center, into the Sears Tower. I mean, they're talking about this way back when. And so it's another thing that further magnifies the failure to stop it, because it wasn't like something that just sort of, you know, popped into their minds a year earlier. We had so many chances to stop this plot, and we missed them all.
Perhaps we missed them, or perhaps they knew about them. They certainly knew who all the terrorists were in America, because immediately after 9/11, within a week, we'd arrested 1,200 Muslims, and many of them are still in jail today. Some of them are just now being indicted for being terrorists. Gee, how did we know who they were within 1 or 2 days of the 9/11 attack, when we had no idea who these terrorists were before that? And I think nobody ever wants to ask those questions.
Well, I would actually go in a different way with that information, because they did arrest all these people in the wake of 9/11, yet just about every single one of them ends up having nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, nothing to do with terrorism. They've all generally been released. However, I've discovered in my research that there are a number of people who seemingly are very important terrorists, very big figures, and they have been released. So it's extremely curious. I have a whole chapter about a fellow named Nabil al-Marab, and he's a really interesting character, because before 9/11, he had more ties to Al-Qaeda than you could shake a stick at. He had a housemate. He was a taxi driver in Boston, and he had a couple housemates that were major Al-Qaeda terrorists, and he actually was convicted of attempted murder before 9/11. So they capture this guy a week after 9/11, and the media accounts say this is one of the 9/11 masterminds. And all these witnesses say we saw him with Mohammed Atta, we saw him with Marwan al-Shehhi, the top 9/11 hijackers. All these neighbors are saying these types of things, and the ties between him and terrorism continue to build up. Almost, you know, literally ridiculous levels. I have a whole chapter about all his ties to terrorism. And then in late 2002, the United States announces Nabil al-Marab has no ties to terrorism, no ties to Al-Qaeda, no ties to 9/11, and we're just letting him go. The judge presiding over the case said, I can't believe this. It seems there's something wrong here. I mean, I don't understand why you're saying that. When you arrested him, you found him with a bag of $60,000 in gems. I mean, you know, he confessed that he was going to try to take a truck and blow up a tunnel in New York, and you're saying he has no ties to terrorism? So now this guy's been released and he's back in Syria. And yet his case is not alone. It's not a unique case. There are a number of people like this who just, you would think that, you know, certainly these people would go on trial, and yet they've just been released.
Unless, of course, they were always undercover agents for the CIA, and, of course, they were arrested and then, of course, turned back so that they could keep infiltrating Al-Qaeda. There is no question in my mind that we had people inside Al-Qaeda, and we knew what was coming down the line. I mean, after all, when the school children in New York knew the attack was coming and took their cameras to school, and this is covered in two books written by my good friend Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who's actually talked to a reporter who tracked down the story, but of course that story never got published outside of New York. It's well known in New York, but the school children were there with their cameras on September 11th because they knew what was the target, they knew the date of the target, but the FBI, those bumbling idiots, just had no idea, but we promoted all of them.
Well, I've never heard that school children's story. I've heard other school children's story, but I haven't heard that particular one, so I'd love if you can, when we're done here, give me that information.
I'll be glad to. In fact, I'll send you a copy of Dr. Cuddy's book, and he's a very careful researcher, you know, almost as meticulous as you are in your work. And so I'll be glad to get that information for you. So anyway, of course, here we are, right? We're finding people being arrested, and they know that they're terrorists, and yet we're letting them go. Why would you do anything that stupid unintentionally? That is the thing that I think that everybody in the listening audience should be asking.
Well, I would also like to point out your comment about that some of these people may be undercover agents and the like, that in the case of Nabil al-Marab, I have one newspaper account from a fellow prisoner when this guy was sharing a prison with another guy before 9/11. he boasted to the other prisoner about his ties to the FBI. He said, I'm not worrying about, you know, staying in this prison very long because I have friends. So you really got to wonder. But there's so much of this information like this that's out there, that's been reported, and yet the general public doesn't know it. So that's what's really driven me to write this book, is to try to correct all these misunderstandings and try to figure out what exactly really happened.
Well, I think what the community got an awful lot of great information. You point out that Moroccan intelligence was telling the American intelligence they're going to be an attack on America, and Jordanian intelligence and British intelligence and French intelligence. Well, why don't you simply go into the background of all the warnings that there were from intelligence agencies all throughout the world telling the United States there's going to be an attack on the United States, they're planning to attack the United States, and of course our intelligence agencies are saying, oh no, it's all going to be overseas, and yet of course they gave the president a presidential daily briefing, a PDB, on the 6th of August, saying Osama bin Laden determined to attack in the United States, something worse to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
How would they say they were planning to attack overseas when they told the president that he was determined to attack the United States on the 6th of August, just 5 weeks before the 9/11 attack? Do you think that they maybe weren't being entirely honest with the American people who said, when they told them that we were sure the attack was coming overseas, when they told the president that Osama was determined to attack the United States?
Well, I have on the website that the book is based on, the cooperativeresearch.org website, I have an essay there called They Tried to Warn Us, where I list all the different foreign government warnings. And there are about a dozen of them, and there's no one warning that puts it all together that says on the day of 9/11 there's going to be an attack on, you know, the Pentagon, World Trade Center, using weapons as airplanes as weapons. However, there are a number of very stunning things in these warnings, saying, for instance, there's going to be multiple simultaneous hijackings.
Of airplanes.
Right. That flying airplanes are going to hit major buildings in the United States, landmark buildings that stick out. Talking about some of the targets, some of the warnings are mentioned that the World Trade Center is going to be a target. It's very, very, provocative stuff. And this isn't from, you know, just sort of some Joe Blow, you know, you don't know to trust. These are coming from U.S. allies. And what you were saying, most of them also, I should mention, were pointing towards attacks in the United States. They're not saying this is going to be an attack in the Persian Gulf or something like that. They're saying these are happening in the United States. And yet, when Norman Mineta, the transportation secretary, he was asked by the 9/11 commission, he said, can you point to one thing that the United States government did to generally protect the U.S. from a terror attack before 9/11, he said, no, I cannot point to a single thing. And these foreign warnings that I'm referring to, these dozen or so warnings, they're not mentioned at all in the 9/11 Commission report, even though these are stories from the New York Times, from, you know, from the biggest newspapers in the United States. These are not, some sort of controversial conspiracy theory. This is very well-established information.
And of course, Condoleezza Rice has said, who could have imagined they would ever take planes and fly them into our buildings? And yet, of course, she was well aware of the fact that this was part of the plan. In fact, you actually talk about how about a month beforehand, there was a meeting over in somewhere in Italy where all the world leaders were together, and they were so frightened of the possibility of them crashing an airplane into that. Why don't you tell that incredible story that a month beforehand, somewhere about that, before the 9/11 attack, they were well aware of the possibility of crashing a plane into the building where these world leaders were. What's the background of that story? What measure did they take at that time to protect the world leaders that they did not take to protect the American people?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad you bring that up, because I think that's one of the most important things. And essentially, the leaders of the G8, the big eight Western countries, were all meeting in Genoa for a big summit, and President Bush was attending. And prior to the meeting, there were a number of media accounts saying that there was this plot by Al-Qaeda to crash an airplane into a building and kill all the world leaders, including President Bush. So this was very widely known, you know, even the BBC did a story, all these other people did a story before it happened. So the Italian government, not, you know, leaving this up to fate, they went to great extremes, with, airline, you know, planes in the air, and surface-to-air missiles.
And didn't they have helicopters, too? Did they have helicopters?
Yeah, and President Bush himself stayed in an aircraft carrier for fear of being hit by an airplane being used as a weapon.
My understanding, many of the world leaders actually stayed on our aircraft carrier because that was safe. It could protect itself from an incoming plane trying to hit it.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yeah. Time magazine talked about this, you know, 2 months before 9/11. There's no way he could say he didn't realize that planes could be used as weapons because they were actually targeting him.
We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty with our special guest, Paul Thompson. Well, Paul, let's go on. Of course, they have this this danger, this in Genoa, maybe a month to 2 months before the 9/11 attack. And so they're well aware that this is a very real attack, and yet Condoleezza Rice goes before the American people and says, who would ever imagine anything like this would happen? And of course, certainly Dick Cheney, and we have his remarks at the press club, I believe it was, the Sunday after the 9/11 attack, saying, well, we knew something was going to happen, but nobody could ever imagine something like this. And I would ask, why not? If he, didn't he see the president's daily briefing? There are 12 paragraphs in that, and 10 of them refer to either hijacking planes or attacking buildings, and they talk about New York and about Washington, D.C. They don't mention the World Trade Center, but they talk about all these buildings being surveyed by the Islamic terrorists, and the heading to that is, of course, Osama bin Laden is determined to strike in the United States. So, I mean, the thing is that when the leaders of our country said we had no idea something like that could happen, they had the presidential daily briefing. They've tried to suppress that. Eventually, it is released. It's up on the staff report. You can get those off the Internet. Although they are carefully censored, there are somebody there, obviously, wanted at least some of the American people to have some idea what happened, and they have some good information in them. The thing that's so disturbing to me, Paul, is the 911 report, commission report, I don't think was trying to get to the truth, because if they had been, they would not have sealed so much of what the information they got for 30 years. If there's nothing to conceal, why would they have concealed so much of their testimony of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people for 30 years? So the American people would never know what they said.
Yeah, I personally think that is essentially a whitewash, the 9/11 Commission. I actually think the congressional inquiry from a year before did a much better job than they did. People don't realize that the 9/11 Commission was a unanimous commission, which means that if there's any one commissioner who has any problem with a particular statement, that statement just gets wiped out of the report.
And for so you have, but President Bush was instrumental in picking not only the chairman, but certainly people on that commission as well in setting up the rules and regulations for it.
Right, and both the Democrats and the Republicans on that commission have all kinds of conflicts of interest that, you know, should have disqualified them from the very get-go.
I can't think of anybody there who shouldn't have been disqualified, from my point of view.
Exactly. So it's not surprising, you know, you get what you ask for, given the people they put in that commission. Sure, there were a few good things that came out of that, some new information, but by and large, it was a whitewash.
Well, hang on. We're going to have to, of course, say goodnight to our listeners up in the great Northwest, but the others will be hanging on. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest for the first hour has been Paul Thompson, and our guest for the second hour will be Paul Thompson. And those of you who are up in the Northwest would like, of course, to get the full 2 hours, why it's available on the Internet, or, of course, you can give us a call of 1-800-544-8927 and get the full 2 hours of this incredible interview with Paul Thompson, who's written The Terrorist Timeline. Now, of course, the rest of our listeners out across America will be here in the second hour, so don't even think about turning off the radio because it's going to be even more exciting as we get to the second hour. But this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we really would appreciate if any of you would seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family. That's how we're able to do what we do. This program is on 3 different satellites in the evening. It's on 2 channels on shortwave. It's on well over a dozen stations or more. And, of course, certainly on several internets. So we do have an opportunity to reach people all across America, but it's an expensive proposition. And if you believe that this information needs to get out, the American people need to hear things that they're not going to get from what I believe is a controlled medium, we hope many of you will give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, you can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter. Certainly our last 2 newsletters, the August newsletter, tells you what Warren Buffett, the multi-billionaire, really thinks about what's happening to our economy, what Alan Greenspan really thinks, not what he says for public consumption. So you'll find the August newsletter fascinating. We'll be glad to send you one free of charge. Now, if you want the September newsletter, we won't send you both unless you subscribe. But if you want the September newsletter, why, this goes into, of course, the history of the monetary system in the United States and what Thomas Jefferson warned us about that is coming to pass today. And, of course, the fact that we are not getting the truth about what's really happening financially. Most people don't understand that our monetary system is built upon illusion. As we often say, it's illusion and delusion. Well, this is really what our monetary system is. Banks create money out of nothing. And if you want to get the background to this, and, of course, the background of the central banks and what their goals and objectives really are, why, you want to get our September newsletter. And hopefully, of course, you can go up on the Internet and pull these down at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Or certainly you can pull down all of our newsletters up there on 911. We have a lot of great information that will help you then. Of course, you can supplement it with this excellent book, The Terrorist Timeline, which we do carry. And in fact, we're going to be carrying that. We're going to be carrying the book by Peter Lance, 1,000 Years for Revenge, which is a fascinating book. In fact, Peter Lance writes the foreword to Paul Thompson's book, The Terrorist Timeline. So certainly you will get information. If you want to get one or both books or find out how to get them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 for The Terrorist Timeline, for Peter Lance's excellent book, 1,000 Years for Revenge. We do hope that many of you will go up to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our program there on the Internet or with the links to the other networks. 5 hours every day, and you won't get much of anything accomplished, but you'll get a lot of information. Your job is to become informed and then help us inform others. And people informing people. I had a fellow call me just before we went on the air named Tom from Syracuse, and he was just simply saying that he always knew something was wrong, but he couldn't put it together, and of course, until somebody had given him some of our tapes and videos. And now I'm sure he'll be joining us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. So we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Remember our all-day seminar on the 6th of November here in North Shore, Monterey Bay, where, of course, we're going to be having lunch and starting early in the morning, going to late in the evening. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 till tomorrow. May the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Paul Thompson, and of course we're talking about his book on the terrorist timeline, which is available through Radio Liberty. And Paul, would you want to tell them about your website, how they can get to your website? We have all sorts of fascinating information.
Sure. www.cooperativeresearch.org, and it has most of the contents of my book on there, and it, in the timeline format, and it also has timelines on some other topics, such as the Iraq War. We're having volunteers getting involved. It's a citizens-based movement to try to put together pieces of information that a lot of people are missing out on.
And so the advantage of here, there's just so much information that's together. A lot of this I had, but a lot of it I didn't have. And he's put this into a very readily followable context. I mean, as you begin reading about how the Moroccans were intelligence warning the United States, the French intelligence warning the United States, the German intelligence warning the United States, the Putin of Russia warning the United States, British intelligence warning the United States, are all saying the attack is coming out the United States. Even the Taliban leaders are warning the United States, Osama bin Laden's going to attack us. And of course, what does Jared Sennett say? Oh, shucks, we thought the attack was going to be overseas because nobody ever told us it was going to be here. And of course, all these other intelligence agencies have their agents working with in Al-Qaeda or tapping Al-Qaeda, and they're listening to all their telephone calls. I mean, we have the most incredible intelligence agencies. They can read your emails. They can read, listen to your telephone conversations. They can track you by satellite. They can track you by all sorts of different means, every telephone call you make. Every time you pick up your telephone or you send a fax, why you're being observed and watched. And we were doing this with the terrorists. And of course they say, well, we can't let the terrorists know how we knew what they were going to be doing, but this is what we knew about them. Well, are we really worried that Osama bin Laden is going to find out how we knew what we was up to, or are they concealing this information from the American people? That's the thing that bothered me as I read through their explanations of why we have to keep all this information secret. Did you have that feeling at all, Paul?
Yeah, I sure did. And I would like to make a point based on something you just said there about how all the warnings, according to the 9/11 Commission and you know, our current leaders, they say all the warnings are pointing overseas. There's a very interesting warning. I don't know if you're aware of this one, but the London Times, which is one of the most respected newspapers in the world, they had a story in late 2001 with focusing on Salman Rushdie. You may know him, the author of the controversial book, The Satanic Verses. Well, Salman Rushdie says that in a few days before 9/11, he was contacted by the FAA, and they warned him, you cannot fly in the United States in the next week. You can fly overseas, but you can't fly in the U.S. There's some sort of something going on, and it's not safe for you to fly. Now, this is very interesting because, of course, who would be after Salman Rushdie with his the fatwa, the sort of the death sentence put on him? There was presumably be somebody in the Middle East trying to kill him, some sort of religious group over there. So this has been completely ignored. And in the story, the FAA actually confirms and says, yes, we did give this warning to Salman Rushdie, but we can't say why. So they're saying that we had no idea of any potential domestic threat. It was all overseas. But the very week of 9/11, they're telling Salman Rushdie, you can't fly in the U.S., you know, we're afraid for your safety on an aircraft. So there's a lot of little pieces like this. This is one of many things that I've discovered that most people don't know about. When you put that together, you start to learn and come to very different conclusions than what the 9/11 Commission comes up with.
You certainly do, and we're going to be back in just a few moments with our special guest together, Paul Thompson, as we explore more of these incredible things. The timeline, of course, will give you tremendous a source of information. It's chronologically arranged, so you can always go back and find these various items as they came up. And I'll tell you, I've learned a lot from this, and I'm sure that anybody who reads this will learn a great deal. As we put together all these questions, and then, of course, he doesn't give us the answers. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Paul Thompson. And course, we were just talking about Salman Rushdie. Now, really very interesting. I'm so glad you brought that story up, because I certainly, about the 20th of September, maybe a week or so, 10 days after the 9/11 attack, why the article appears in the London Times. And, of course, it's quoted by an American website called Ananova. I believe that's the correct pronunciation for it. And it tells this story from the London Times, but I don't want to take something down off the internet. I want to go to the original source. So we pull down the London Times for that day on the internet, and there's no reference to the story. The day that Ananova quotes the London Times carrying the story on Salman Rushdie, it's not there. So, well, then how can we possibly use it? After all, everything in the London Times is up on the internet site, or is it? Well, of course, eventually we got copies of the London Times for that day, and that's exactly what the story told about Salman Rushdie being told not to fly. So somebody had pulled it down off the London Times website, or maybe it didn't get put up there. But the alternative would be somebody had pulled that down. Now, who has the ability to pull things down off the internet? Who has the power, the electronic ability to do that? Other than some form of American intelligence agency. And the same thing happened with the story of Willie Brown. I'm sure you know that story, don't you, Paul?
Oh, yeah.
Would you like to tell our listeners the story of Willie Brown? Because that story was on the Chronicle website, but somebody pulled it down off the internet. It only appeared in one edition of the San Francisco Chronicle and then disappeared off their website mysteriously. And do you know who Joseph Fair is?
I believe so. Doesn't he write? Yeah, he writes the World Net Daily.
I was in a meeting with Joe, and he was telling me how he'd been trying to track down this story, but it wasn't on the website. He couldn't get a copy of the paper, so maybe it wasn't true. And I reached in my pocket and pulled out a copy of the article for him, and I said, my gift to you, Joe. And, of course, we had a copy of the article somebody had sent to me, appeared in the paper one day, and somebody pulled that down off the web. Or maybe it just didn't get up there, but everything in the newspaper goes on the web unless, well, tell the story of why this was so important.
Well, before I do, I just want to point out to the listeners out there that one thing about the website version of my book, The Terror Timeline, is that when you look up the information there, say the Salman Rushdie story, I have a little paragraph about it, and then at the end, I have the source, London Times, whatever the day may be. You can click on that link, and more times often than not, it will take you directly to that source article. So I'm trying to save all these articles from being lost to obscurity, and I also don't want, people to think, oh, how do I know if this guy is properly,
for just a moment.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening is Paul Thompson. He's just saying that so many of the things or everything in his book, you'll find a reference for it, a place on the web you can go, a place you can go to CBS or NBC or to Time Magazine. So, and of course, it's so convenient as you go to the website because you can actually click on those sites and it'll take you right to the original article, which is a great idea. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, and, if it's disappeared from the web, then we save a copy and hopefully you can find it that way. And as I was saying, how does the reader or listener out there know that they can trust me? So I want them to go to the original articles and read all these things for themselves. Don't take my word for it. So we have thousands of articles out there that are the source articles for all this information, so people can get informed themselves.
All right, well, what is the story about Willie Brown? Why was that important? Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco.
He claims that hours before, I believe it was the night before, he was warned not to fly the next day, the next morning, which would have been the morning of 9/11. Now, there's some questions about this story, whether this was just a coincidence or maybe he just happened to hear some other warning. I don't know. It's one of those things where there hasn't been a proper investigation. But I think another interesting story that we could also throw into the same category is that Newsweek, shortly after 9/11, twice gave a story saying that a number of top generals the night before 9/11 were warned not to fly the next morning. And Newsweek at the time said, no doubt this warning given to the top generals will be a subject of much public debate. Why were they warned and the general public was not? But of course, as you know and I know, that there was never any public debate about that. That story just disappeared.
Well, my friend, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, actually called the reporter who wrote the article who wouldn't discuss it. He got hold of Evan Thomas, I believe that's the name, who was the publisher or the editor of Newsweek, and asked him about those articles you referred to, and Evan Thomas said, oh, well, I don't believe in conspiracies. And Dr. Cuddy said, well, we're not saying it's a conspiracy. This is what you wrote in your article. I mean, who were these men? And Evan Thomas said, well, if there's anything to it, why it's being investigated by Congress, they'll get to the bottom of it. And Dr. Cuddy said, but we're not interested in investigation. Who were these men? And Evan Thomas said, I don't want to talk about it. I mean, Dr. Cuddy is a very, very good, a thorough investigator, believe me. He's right on top of all these stories. And so, and as far as the story of Willie Brown is concerned, I actually personally contacted Willie Brown's press officer, asked him about the story, and he confirmed the story to me. He told that Willie Brown had been contacted by their security consultant the evening before, approximately about 10 o'clock in the evening, and warned that they would be very cautious flying the following day. And he told me, he said, well, this isn't the first time. We had another one of these warnings back in July of warning us. Of course, we know that they sent that warning out in July because they thought the attack was coming in July. So they warned important people in July. They warned important people just before September 11th. But they didn't warn Barbara Olson, or warn the other people who were there on those four doomed airliners.
Well, I must say I'm really impressed. I'm glad that you and other people that you know are trying to get to the bottom of these stories, because as your anecdote there with the Newsweek reporter shows, that unfortunately the media has often failed to really follow up. They're supposed to be the watchdogs, you know, and protecting the public. And I think when it comes to 9/11, they've shown a very strong lack of curiosity. And
well, fortunately, you see, we all have to work together, Paul. We don't have the millions of dollars that they have for the government to waste on reports that are not going to say anything. Dennis Cuddy works out of his home. You work out of, I assume, your home and off the Internet. And I work out of, in between planning my radio programs. But we have access to a small handful of people who really want to get the truth. But I think you've done us a great job by just putting this all together chronologically. I really appreciate it. So much your work.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's get on with this story. And so now, of course, there are all these prior warnings. And, of course, you tell the story about some Iranian fellow who's in jail who's trying to call the FBI to tell them they're going to attack the World Trade Center. What was that story all about?
Well, that's another mystery story that just seems to have gotten lost. But he claims to have warned or tried a number of times to call, you know, people in power, and people were saying, oh, you're just a prisoner, who wants to listen to you? But his prison guards eventually let him make a number of calls to the United States, and he was able to talk to people, and you can put it down as another missed opportunity, because here's yet another person warning these things. And this is actually not the only prisoner who's giving out warnings. We also have, I think, a possibly more interesting case is the story of Walid Arkeh. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but A-R-K-E-H. Are you familiar with his case?
No, and I certainly can't pronounce those Arab names. I know how you struggle with them.
Well, if you let me tell his story, he is a prisoner who was in Britain and convicted of some relatively minor things. I don't remember, but things like failure to pay child support and the like. He wasn't a major criminal. But he was put in a prison near three very important Al-Qaeda agents, including a man who was basically bin Laden's public spokesman in Britain. And he was Muslim, and they were Muslim, and they all got along very well, and before long they started telling him secrets. And then he was transferred to the United States, and he was in a prison there in Florida, and he tried to warn the U.S. officials and the FBI about what he'd learned from these high-level prisoners. And he learned such things as, they said, that basically Al-Qaeda was very determined to finish up the job they'd failed to do in 1993 and attack the World Trade Center. And he had some information like this that was very important. And the FBI ignored him. He repeatedly tried to warn them, and after after 9/11, some other FBI people talked to him and heard his story, and they could barely believe it. They said, is this for real? If what you're saying is true, we're all in deep doo-doo because this was a very key warning. And yet that story also never made it beyond a few newspapers in Florida. I actually talked to the reporter who did that story, and she said she thought it was important enough to try to get it out to the major media outlets, and they all said the same thing to her, which was a catch-22. They said, well, if it's only being reported in Florida, then it must not be an important story worthy of being a national story.
So, and of course, it's only being reported in Florida because the rest of the country is not reporting it at first. I think the story of David Shippers, though, here is a very prominent individual, the counsel for the House Impeachment Committee, a Democrat who's selected by the Republicans to be the counsel for the committee that impeached the President of the United States. Why is David Shippers' story so important and poignant at this point?
Well, I don't know the full details of his story. I know that he's also, in addition to 9/11, he's very interested in the Oklahoma City bombing, and he sees connections between the two. He claims that there are a number of FBI agents who were in contact with him before 9/11 and were trying to pass on warnings, and that they were basically ignored.
But he actually had been told by them that there was going to be an attack. Did they tell him what they were going to attack? It was just in Lower Manhattan.
The details on that one, again, I think are different stories say different things. But as you mentioned, there was a Lower Manhattan warning, apparently. And he claims that to this day, there are these FBI agents who have information and want to come forward and are afraid to come forward because they're worried about what will happen to them. And he says that because he was a rather prominent political figure, he thought that he would be able to get the story out before 9/11, meaning get it to the right people so that something could be done, but he found that everybody was ignoring him.
None of it would talk to him. He knew John Ashcroft. John Ashcroft would not talk to him. He knew the leaders of the House of Representatives on a first-name basis, and none of them would talk to him about the coming attack. And you have to ask yourself, why?
Yeah.
In fact, I have another story that told me by a very reliable individual, one of the most prominent scientists in America, who'd done a good deal of work with members of the FBI because of some of the work he'd done in the Gulf War syndrome. And he tells me that he was told that on September 11th they were going to attack the Pentagon, didn't say anything at all about the World Trade Center. He actually relayed this information to high government officials. Needless to say, he was never invited to appear before the 911 Commission. And the people who did appear before the 911 Commission, like Peter Lance, they took the testimony and then they sealed it for 30 years. They sealed it for 30 years. And I would ask, if there's nothing to conceal, why did they take all that testimony and seal it for 30 years? 30 years from now, will we find out that this whole thing was a fraud, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident? I like the fact that they had foreknowledge of what happened on the December 7th, what happened to the Maine, the blowing up of the battleship Maine in 1898 that got us into the Spanish-American War. It was all a lie. Are we going to find out later, 30 years from now, that we were not told the truth about why we went to war with Afghanistan and why we went to war with Iraq and all those boys died for nothing? Remember, 58,000 American boys died in Vietnam because of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And now all the evidence shows it never really happened. And we never really tried to win the war over there. And the war was fought for entirely different reasons than we're ever allowed to know. And let's fast forward then to what's going on now. Why are they sealing all this information, classifying it? Because criminal activity to ever reveal anything that the 9/11 Commission learned that they don't want you to know. Is this how we operate in a free and open society where the people are to determine the course of their government? Is this what you see when you have a government that is run by somebody else who has another agenda? I just asked the questions. You will have to come up with the answers. We'll be right back in a few moments with our special guest tonight. And we're going to be talking about Paul Thompson's the terrorist timeline. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Paul, now, of course, let's get into the Bojinka plot, because I think this is, to me, one of the most fascinating parts of this whole story, or whether we call it the Bojinka plot, or the third part of the plot that was laid out in 1994, in December of 94. Could you give that incredible story? Because this suggests to me that the government knew that the World Trade Center was a target, and they knew they were going to hijack planes and crash it into that. And for some strange reason, they did nothing to protect that, and they've done everything to cover up this story. So why don't you tell the story of what happened and what has been discovered?
Well, I'm impressed with what you know about this, because the Bojinka plot has been the subject of a lot of misunderstanding. Peter Lance has done some really great work on this. Essentially, the Bojinka plot was supposed to take place, at least the first part of it, in January 1995. And Ramzi Youssef, a very big criminal mastermind, genius bomber, he's also the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind.
And he was also the architect of the first bombing of the World Trade Center.
Right. He and his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, are in the Philippines, and they have an ambitious plot to, first of all, kill the Pope, and with just a conventional bomb as he's traveling through Manila. Secondly, at roughly the same time, set off about 12 bombs on aircraft flying over the Pacific, killing thousands. And then the third part, which was to take place later, undetermined time, but they said after the effects of the first two attacks had worn off, then they would fly airplanes into buildings, and they had a number of pilots who were all ready to go, and they mentioned, you know, specific targets like the World Trade Center, CIA headquarters. They had a whole bunch already picked out, a nuclear power plant, and this was not to be. None of this happened because luckily there was a small fire in the apartment they were staying in, and some Philippine investigators arrested a couple of them, and some of the others got away, but they were able to foil the plot. And so what you're talking about is now then the unraveling of that plot, how the investigators are finding out about it. And when I'm saying there's a lot of misunderstanding is that, as Peter Lance points out in his book, Cover Up, there's this one quote from the investigations that made a lot of news. And when people talk about Bojinka, they always talk about this quote, which is one of the people who'd been arrested saying, "I was willing to take a plane and fly it into CIA headquarters." So this has made the rounds, and people have been under the misunderstanding that the Bojinka plot involved crashing a whole bunch of planes over the Pacific plus one plane to be flown into the CIA headquarters, when in fact it was basically two separate plots happening at different times, and the flying of the plane into the CIA headquarters was to be part of the second wave to come later. And that second wave is, for all practical purposes, the 9/11 plot. It morphed, it changed over time. They cut down on the number of airplanes, but the targets basically were picked out way back then, and the method of attack was picked out way back then, and the training of pilots in the U.S., you know, all the details, really. It was just the 9/11 attack was essentially a fulfillment of the Bojinka plot.
And I think it's so important that we know that they involved, well, we're going to tell that in just a moment here when we bring our other stations back on. All right, well, I guess this evening is Paul Thompson. We're talking about the terrorist timeline, and of course, Paul has been talking about the Bojinka plot. There were actually three parts to the Bojinka plot. Number one, kill the Pope in January of 1995 when he came to Manila. Number two, explode, put bombs on 12 planes, American planes, would be flying across the Pacific. And of course, these were not suicide plots. They were to plant the bombs, of course, attached to a wristwatch igniter, and of course they would plant the bombs on the first leg of the flight. They would get off the flight, and that plane then would be going over the Pacific, and 12 American planes would go down simply because the small bomb that they had would ignite the fuel in the central fuel tank of the plane, and of course the plane would explode out over the Pacific, killing everybody on board. The third part of the plot involved hijacking planes and crashing them into the Sears Tower in Chicago, into the World Trade Center in New York, into the Transamerica Tower in San Francisco, into the Pentagon, and sometimes into the White House, sometimes the CIA, probably the CIA and the White House, but I think there's a Pentagon. Those were the five things that they mentioned, and this was what's known as the Bojinka plot. And we know that the government, although they deny knowing anything about it, I have an article that I pulled down on the internet right after 9/11, written by a man named Bill Gertz. It was published on the Northwest Airline Stewardess's side, I think that is. Anybody would like to see this. Bill Gertz, who gets leaks from the CIA all the time, this is a Bill Gertz backgrounder, and it says there is a plot, the Bojinka plot, to hijack American planes and fly them into the World Trade Center, the Sears Tower, the Transamerica building, the Pentagon, and maybe the CIA building or the White House. I've forgotten which they are. And we have copies of that. Bill Gertz has forgotten he wrote it. Bill Gertz, a very good man, very excellent reporter, but he just forgot that he wrote this article. But we have it, and we got it right after 9/11. It was written 2 months beforehand, so it was up on the internet. It was there. And, of course, the interesting thing is every other mention of that part of the Bojinka plot, when Christine Breitwiser talked about it at the testimony, when she testified before the Joint Select Committee on Intelligence, totally deleted from any mention of the media of that. When Insight magazine put that out in an article, next thing we know, Insight magazine is closed down because they can't get any advertisers. So everybody who talks about that aspect of the Bojinka plot, it's almost as if somebody doesn't want the public to know. Do you have that feeling, Paul?
Well, the curious thing about it is that, as Peter Lance points out, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, shortly after this, becomes a wanted man for his role in the first World Trade Center bombing and the Bojinka plot. He's clearly one of the most dangerous men alive.
And he's actually indicted, but they keep the indictment secret so nobody will know he's been indicted.
Yeah, and everything that comes out publicly in the trials of Ramzi Youssef and so forth relating to the Bojinka plot and fail to mention this third wave. And it seems like they're going out of their way not to talk about it. For instance, the Philippine investigator who was able to find out about the third wave, he was not called to testify in New York. His assistant was, and his assistant never mentioned his boss, never mentioned the plot. It was as if there was some sort of order to say, you know, nobody talk about this.
And of course, the man who really did the interrogation was Colonel Mendoza of the Philippine Police Force, and his assistant didn't even remember his name when he testified at the Ramzi Youssef trial. There's something wrong with this whole story, almost as if somebody's trying to keep this information from the American people.
Yeah, and you know, this is also just curious about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I mean, here's this guy, clearly a huge terrorist, very important, and yet there doesn't seem to be much effort to try to get him.
Have you ever noticed that he's been actually captured now for a year, year and a half, and he's never been brought to trial? Of course, they give you extensive descriptions of his testimony, what he's told the people in the staff report of the 911 Commission, not what you can buy on the local bookstand, but the staff report really has some excellent material in it. And I wonder why they don't try this mass murderer who really was the mastermind behind 911. Are they afraid to put him on trial? Are they afraid, like Zacharias Massui, that he knows too much about what really happened, that they really don't want to try him?
If they ever do try him, I'm sure, certain it will be a military tribunal that will be shrouded in secrecy.
And I think in a free society, why do we have to have so much secrecy? If there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? And those are the questions we have to ask. 3,000 Americans died, of course, in the tragedy of 9/11. another 1,000 Americans have died in Afghanistan. Probably another close to another 1,000 of the contract workers have died over there, Americans. They've died in Afghanistan. Hundreds have died in Afghanistan. I fear that tens of thousands are going to die before this is all over, and we're not getting the truth. We'll be back here in just a moment, here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Paul Thompson, his book, and if you haven't read it, let me recommend it to you. It's the Terrorist Timeline, if you're interested in getting it, of course. You can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We also carry Peter Lanz's excellent book. In fact, one of the last 50 copies of the hardbound book that's available, the 1,000 Years for Revenge, and so much of the information in these two books, it overlaps. Well, of course, we've talked about the Operation Bazooka, and obviously you have the same feeling that I do, that somebody really doesn't want this whole story brought out, or they don't want the facts about the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed brought out. Would you have that feeling?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we learned some incredible things about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. For instance, it has come out that in the summer of 2001, the NSA, the satellite eyes and ears of the United States, they actually record Khalid Sheikh Mohammed talking to Mohammed Atta, the head hijacker. What were they saying in that conversation? We don't know. Was that a complete open map to the 9/11 plot? I mean, it would be hard to see how you could have those two talking and not unravel the plot. But they also have some other messages where he's saying that he's bringing people into the United States to take part in a terror mission. And yet, supposedly, all these messages are, you know, filed away and put in the not very important category, even though at this time, despite the curious lack of interest about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they did go to at least lengths of putting a $2 million reward out for him, putting a poster up for him. So it cannot be denied that they were aware that he was a major terrorist. And yet, you capture an intercept saying, I'm bringing terrorists to the United States, and that's not followed up, that's not investigated. It really begs belief.
Well, of course, I like the wonderful story about that terrorist who walks into the FBI headquarters in Newark, New Jersey, and said, I'm a terrorist. We're here to, blow up your buildings, and we're going to hijack your planes. And they say, get him out of the United States and make sure he leaves. And, of course, why didn't they want to follow through and investigate? Unless, of course, they knew much more than they wanted the American people to know. This is the thing, the haunting feeling I have is they knew so much about what was going to happen that morning. And of course, nothing was done to stop it. That is the frightening implication, at least that I derive. But everybody's going to have to get their own information. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about what happened that morning. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening certainly is Paul Thompson. His book, The Terror Timeline, you want to get this, you want to read it, and it's a fascinating book. What happened that morning? Why were there no fighter planes in the air that morning? Why couldn't they bring in the fighter planes from Andrews Air Force Base, 2 minutes away from Washington, D.C., to intercept the plane that they know is going to come in and hit the Pentagon? What happened that morning, and what is this story about? There were actually war games going on that morning. There really were planes there simulating attacks on buildings by terrorists. What's this all about?
Well, I can see that you're very knowledgeable about all these things, and I think for a person like you or me who becomes really knowledgeable, it's so fascinating, and I think you may share my frustration that other people don't know about these things and that the media isn't generally reporting them. But from what the media has reported, we can piece together a lot of things. And on the day of 9/11, I think the key fact to remember is that the attacks took about 2 hours. The first plane, Flight 11, was hijacked at about 8:13 in the morning, East Coast time. And the last plane crashed into the Pennsylvania country at about 10:06. So you're just shy of 10 minutes shy of 2 hours. Now, fighters, U.S. military fighters, at the time, they were promised that they could get into the air within 15 minutes. So you have fighters that are in the region, and you have essentially a two-hour attack, and fighters are supposed to get up in 15 minutes. So why on earth were these planes flying around without any fighters anywhere near them? You might say, okay, well, you know, the first one, everyone was surprised. Maybe even the second one, people still don't get it. But the fourth plane, when that finally crashed into the Pennsylvania countryside after flying around for a very long time, it was probably realized as a hijacking at least by about 9:30. So almost 40 minutes it's flying around after all these other things have already happened, and there's still no fighter anywhere near that plane.
At least we're told there's no fighters anywhere near
that
plane.
Well, we're told. Oh, yeah, according to the official story. I mean, we don't know for a fact. But, if you look at the third plane, Flight 77, it's a similar kind of situation where that one was known to have been hijacked, known to be missing at least, for over half an hour, and yet it crashes into Washington, D.C., the capital. You would think if there's one place that you would be protecting, it would be there. Where are the fighters there? So this has been a big mystery, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of it.
Well, Chris, have you ever talked or found anything about the missile batteries? Because, of course, Jim Mars talks about the missile batteries, that they were there guarding Washington, D.C. and guarding the Pentagon, and several people have talked about the fact that we have missile batteries. They've actually been anticipating attack on the Pentagon. They've even had a trial simulating an attack on the Pentagon by hijackers crashing a plane into it. What about the missile batteries? Have you looked into that at all, anything about it?
Well, I've heard of some of these preparations. You know, there were specific preparations for planes crashing into the Pentagon. In fact, you can find online a war game. You can find photos of actually them, a team of military strategists who had built a model of the Pentagon, and they put in the middle of it wreckage of a plane right in the middle, and they even have it on fire and everything. And this all came out before 9/11. So we see all these war games. In fact, another one, if you allow me to digress a little bit, that I didn't know about until very recently, came out in the 9/11 Commission final report, says that Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar, in 1999, he led an exercise, and the exercise was imagining a plane taking off from Atlanta, Georgia, flying to Washington, D.C., gets hijacked, it crashes into a building in Washington, D.C. So they're wargaming this out, and it involves NORAD, who are the military responders, the controlling the fighters, the Secret Service, and the FAA, and Richard Clark is heading it. So how can you say that they had no idea that planes could be used as weapons? This is completely ridiculous. But if I can quickly to answer your question then about missiles and surface-to-air missiles, I have come across one report in the Telegraph, the British newspaper, stating that the White House had a surface-to-air missile battery that was to defend Washington, D.C. I've never come across anything about there being something on the Pentagon. However, you don't need something on the Pentagon because the range of the one that would be on the White House would certainly cover anything coming into Washington, D.C. And we know that the Flight 77 practically flew right over the White House.
In fact,
so why was that not used that morning?
In fact, as Christine Breitweiser said in her testimony before the House Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, why that plane actually did a loop-de-loop around the Pentagon, flew all around the Pentagon before it came in to attack it. You know, one of the most interesting things is we know that they evacuated the White House, you know, and about 30 minutes later, of course, they had not evacuated the Pentagon. And that, of course, is when the Pentagon was hit and a number of people were killed. And the question is, if they are going to evacuate the White House because they know the plane is coming in, why didn't they evacuate the Pentagon? Nobody's asked that question, I guess.
Yeah, well, so many unanswered questions, so many even unasked questions, really, by the media.
And especially the 911 Commission did not ask any of the important questions. That, I think, what people have to understand. The 911 Commission, in my estimation, was a whitewash to make the American people feel we were going to get to the bottom, to put them to sleep, while, of course, we proceeded with a war in the Middle East.
What else was I going to say on that topic?
We're talking about the missiles and the failure to evacuate the Pentagon.
Oh yes, I know what it was. I haven't come across much about the early evacuation of the White House, although I've been told by people, anecdotally that happened, but I did come across a mention that the Treasury Department had an early evacuation.
Well,
why would you evacuate the Treasury Department but not evacuate another equally important building?
Well, you actually find that statement, Norman Mineta's testimony before the 911 Commission. We have it. If you don't have a copy of it, I can get it to you. And he said, you know, that he was called, after the attack in New York and asked to come to the White House. And when he got to the White House, they were already evacuating it. And so he was taken down into the Presidential Emergency Operating Center there where he was with Dick Cheney. And then, of course, he describes them monitoring the plane as it's coming in to hit the Pentagon. In his testimony actually says, I got to the White House, they were evacuating it, and then I went down into the basement, and there we were monitoring the plane, and they would say the plane is 30 miles out, or the plane is 50 miles out, the plane is 30 miles out, the plane is 10 miles out, and then the young man said to the president, Vice President, do the orders still stand? And the vice president said, yes, the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And we have that from Norman Mineta's testimony. And, of course, somebody says, what were the orders? And Mineta says, I don't know. And nobody ever wanted to ask that question again.
Yeah, well, there are so many contradictions, and Norman Mineta is a really classic example where his account of what happened that morning is in complete contradiction to Dick Cheney's account. Norman Mineta claims that when he came into the bunker there underneath the White House around 9:20, that Dick Cheney was already there and he was giving that command as you just described, whereas Dick Cheney says that he didn't even arrive at the bunker until a couple minutes before 10. And this is just one of many examples where if you look at the testimony of the top people responding that day, people like Richard Myers, the chief of the military, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the acting head. You look at Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary. You look at Dick Cheney. You look at Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy defense secretary. You look at all these different people. They have these wildly different accounts, and you can't really reconcile them. You know, one person says he's at one thing, and then someone else says that person was somewhere else.
Did you ever have a feeling that they're intentionally trying to get us so confused we can't think things through clearly?
My take on that is I think that this is what you call CYA, cover your ass. That they are trying to protect themselves by coming up spinning stories that say that they were somewhere else, and so don't blame me.
Perjury, though.
They do, at least if they get them to testify under oath, which was another problem of the 9/11 Commission, that they didn't do that nearly enough. But some of them testified under oath, and I think that some of them, if you really look, they must have committed perjury. You even have accounts from the same person wildly contradicting themselves, like Richard Myers is a classic example, the acting Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's given accounts of what he did on the morning of 9/11 that are in utter contradiction. For instance, he said at one point that just after the second plane hit, that he picked up the phone and started talking to other NORAD people, and so he's aware of what's going on from a very early stage. And then another account, he says that he didn't have any idea that there were any attacks happening until after the Pentagon was hit, which was some 40 minutes later. So, which is right? His first account or his second account? And it's just, to me, it's really disturbing how these people who are still leading the country and responsible for our security, that they can't even get their story straight about what they were doing on 9/11.
Well, either they're not telling the truth, they're incredibly stupid and incompetent, or they are intensely trying to confuse the American people. And I always like to go back to a wonderful story written by the woman who wrote the murder on the Orient Express, Agatha Christie. And, of course, the crux of the whole story, there were just too many clues. And the master detective, Monsieur Poirot, gets all of these clues, and he keeps looking at the clues. And there's so many clues there that all contradict one another. And he finally says, there are too many clues. There are too many clues. And I think that's really what we see when we see 9/11. There are too many clues. They all contradict one another. And, of course, they're all planted there intensely to confuse him. And he finally, of course, sees through the whole clever charade and finds out who the murderer is. I won't tell the people who the murderer was. If you haven't read the story of the murder on the Orient Express, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, where we tell you the story of the murder on the Orient Express against the background of what's happening in America today. But that's another story. Right now, let's get back to the morning of 9/11. You know, it would seem that there were many opportunities to get our fighter planes in the air, and somebody was almost like intentionally not getting our armed planes into the air. Did you have that feeling?
Well, I just, to go back to what you're saying there about the clues, you know, I would just encourage the listeners out there, don't get thrown off by all this confusing information and all these false trails, because we absolutely have to get to the bottom of this. 9/11 is such a pivotal event in world history. And, you know, how can we not know, how can we not have an investigation and not figure out what really happened that day? So it's too important to just say, oh, well, it's all kind of confusing, you know, it hurts my head, never mind. That's why I've worked so hard to try to figure this out, because there's so many decisions now that are being made based on assumptions about what happened on 9/11 and who's to blame and so forth. And a lot of these assumptions are false assumptions. So we have to figure out what really happened if we're going to move forward.
I agree with you totally, and I think you've done a yeoman's job at putting together this compilation. And, you know, if you begin reading the 911 Commission report, testimony there, and of course Langley Air Force Base is 110 miles from Washington, D.C. America's under attack. They've got their fighter planes there. So what do? Instead of flying their planes directly to Washington, D.C., they send them out over the Atlantic Ocean. And then, of course, instead of bringing them in at supersonic speed, 1,800 miles an hour, they have them flying about, less than 9/10 of Mach, which is about 600 miles an hour now. If the country's under attack and the plane is coming in to crash into the White House or the Pentagon, why would they bring those planes in at less than that? Anybody wants the documents out of NORAD, we have them, or you can go to the NORAD website and actually pull down the information yourself. They were flying at subsonic speeds after first going out over the Atlantic Ocean. That's not the way to the White House, ladies and gentlemen, but that's the testimony. I'm sure you've come across this as well, haven't you, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at these accounts, it's almost surreal. It's so bizarre. like there's some NORAD official who says that the fighters were chasing after the hijacked plane, quote, like a scalded ape, unquote, and then he goes on to say they're flying 500 miles an hour. Now, the hijacked planes themselves are flying 500 miles an hour or more, so if they're flying like a scalded ape after them, they literally could have gone across the country and never caught up to them, because they're actually flying slower than the things they're trying to catch up to, according to some NORAD official. So stories like that, they just don't make sense, or if they're true, it's just phenomenal, you know, unbelievable behavior on the part of the fighter pilots that day.
Well, I think we're repeatedly told that NORAD was, of course, prepared to defend us from an exterior attack, never from within. We had no idea that there could be hijacking of American planes, and yet there are so many examples of where NORAD had actually had feigned or practiced runs of intercepting hijackers that were going to attack our planes. They had done this over and over and over again. And, of course, some of the recent reports suggest that some of those programs were taking place on the morning of September 11th. That's why some people actually thought that this was simply a make-believe attack. Did you run into that story at all, Paul?
Yeah, I did. There's a lot of curious things going on with that story. There was a U.S. organization, a government organization called the National Reconnaissance Office, and they're based in Washington, D.C. They're kind of a satellite surveillance group that apparently has a lot of CIA involvement. And on the morning of 9/11, they were having a exercise that actually involved the crashing of an airplane into their building. This is much like a fire drill, where they're drilling for this type of event. And it's actually going on. It's supposed to happen at 9 o'clock, and it's 4 miles away from the airport where the real plane is taking off, you know, to crash into a building. Like, what are the odds?
Well, there's so many unanswered questions, but our guest this evening has been Paul Thompson. I hope you've enjoyed our program. And, of course, you'll want to get his The Terror Timeline. And, of course, year by year, day by day, minute by minute, a comprehensive chronicle of the road to 9/11, America's response. Paul, thank you so much for being with us this evening. I hope we can get you back on some of other programs. We do 5 hours of talk radio a day, so we do have 3 different audiences, actually 4 different audiences, and I want people to get your material and read it. God bless you. Thanks for being with us. Well, let's just keep you around for just a moment or two before we let you go.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Paul Thompson has written this wonderful book. Paul, we've got 3 minutes before I let you go, and I'll call you back right after the program and tell you how we can get that, find out how we can get a copy of Dr. Cuddy's book to you, because he's a very good researcher. But what message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening? What have you learned after doing this exhaustive study, spending several years collecting the information, all of it documented from reliable sources? What have you learned?
Well, I would say that right now we're living in a time of fear where people are worrying about another terror attack and what's going to happen to the country. And I think we absolutely have to know what's happened in our recent history. And my book goes back to 1979 and the whole phenomenon of Al-Qaeda. We have to know that so that, you know, we'll be prepared when we have to make decisions in the future, be it are we going to go to war in Iraq, are we going to go to war somewhere else, who do we want to lead the country and what should they do? We need to be informed citizens. There was a poll saying 70% of the people think that Saddam Hussein was the mastermind of 9/11. If we go forward with that kind of misunderstanding, our country is going to go in the wrong direction. We absolutely have to know this kind of material, and we have to get to the bottom of what happened on 9/11.
And I think, of course, if you really go into the background of the Islamic terrorist movement, it will actually lead you to Iran and Saudi Arabia. And, of course, who brought the Iranian to power? Who toppled the Shah and brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power? Why the American CIA? Why would you do anything that foolish? Destroy a friend of America and bring an enemy to power? And that is the haunting question that we often ask and ponder. Because, of course, I believe that the next country to be attacked will either be Syria or Iran. I believe that if you read what the people from the Project for the New American Century are putting out in the way of propagandizing the American people day after day after day, they're talking about the danger of Iran. We're going to have a preemptive strike on Iran. Iran is going to have a preemptive strike on American forces. I think that the war is going to go on. Paul Thompson, I want to thank you so much for being with us, your guest, and for your really exhaustive work of putting together something that I'm going to keep as a constant source of research, and I hope you're going to continue your effort to update this information and put in the information as it shows up, because the truth is out there. We've just got to find it.
Oh, I'm definitely going to keep on going until I drop or I find out what happened on 9/11.
God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us, Paul.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, fine. Our guest has been Paul Thompson. His book, The Terror Timeline. If you want to know more about getting it, our number 1-800-544-8927. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, we're talking about this wonderful book. We think it's really a very important part of the armamentarium of knowing what happened that morning. The book, The Terror Timeline, and of course, written by Paul Thompson. And of course, we carry that. We're going to be carrying the book, A Thousand Years for Revenge, written by Peter Lance. We had actually just did an interview with Peter this morning, and we'll be having him on. We have a two-tape set, two-hour interview with Peter Lance, and we'll be having, of course, I think a four-tape set with these two sets, really to try to get people to understand of what indeed is going on. So don't despair. Why we're going to continue trying to get the information out. Of course, we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our program to help us as we get the information out across the United States. So if you would like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters or know more about our organization, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com, and you can pull down our newsletters. You can pull down our programs directly or indirectly 5 hours every day and listen on the American Freedom Network. That's AmericanNewsNet.com, on the Genesis Network, GCNLive.com, on the Radio Liberty Network. That's radioliberty.com, on the Republic Network. And I don't have RBN, I believe it is, RBN.com. We'll get that for you. That's a new one we're on. And then, of course, the Soundwave Network as well. So many, many ways to get our program. We're so fortunate to have the outreach we do. And your job out there in the audience is to reach your friends and tell them about our ministry. Tell them they're going to get information here they're not going to get elsewhere. And we encourage you to listen to our programs, to support our effort, to tell your friends, to go to your local radio station, ask them if they'll pull down our program. If you go to our website, you can read our newsletters, and we give you our permission to copy them. You have our permission to copy any of our videos or book, pardon me, or tape sets we put together. As long as you're not making a profit on them, copy them and get them out. And people are reaching people, And believe me, people across America are looking for answers, and we have them. A lot of people out there don't want to hear that there's a problem, but when they understand that they're poisoning their children with the fluoride and with the aspartame and with mercury, and I ask the question, why do they want to hurt the children? Why do they want to hurt the children? And if they really would, if they really are intentionally putting things in our vaccines to be harmful, if they're putting things in our food and drinks like aspartame, which is a poison, to harm our children and our people, if they're putting things in the drinking water like fluoride, which will harm our people, are these people capable of doing almost anything to further their goal? And what is their goal? Their goal is a new world order, a new world economy, a new world currency, and a new world religion. And, of course, I believe that the leader of this new world religion will be the Antichrist himself or his representative, and we're moving towards that goal. Remember, there is a trinity of evil, as there is a trinity of a heavenly trinity of God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. So there's the trinity of evil of Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet. Who is the false prophet? Who is the Antichrist? Well, we know who Satan is, and I think we'll soon know who the others are. If you do not understand we're involved in a spiritual battle, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, get the other items that are there. We'd be glad to send you a free newsletter. We'll send you a catalog. Get the information. Help us to disseminate the truth while there's still time. And so until tomorrow, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because behind everything that's going on is organized evil. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Remember our November 6th meeting here in Santa Cruz, and if you want to come, call us at 1-800-544-8927. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.